All right, and joining us now is always a pleasure to talk to Eric Peters. He has ericpetersautos.com, a lot of great articles about liberty, about politics, and also about cars and mobility, because that is a big part of our liberty, is that mobility. And so he covers that, and he does actual real car reviews. I mean, not just the hypercars that cost millions and millions of dollars, but real cars that are out there. And so it's always a pleasure to have Eric on. Thank you for joining us, Eric.
Oh, thank you, David. I'd like to know, though, first, before we get going, have you got your golden shoes on?
I passed on that. I did a thing. I came in with golden slippers, you know, while they were showing the things, you know, the old miner's tune. And
I thought you'd like that.
Isn't that something, you know? And next, maybe, you know, when he mandates masks again, we can all make them out of gold. That, I'm sure that InfoWars will probably do that and sell it.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay, so we had, like I called it yesterday, Stupor Tuesday. You had to be in a stupor to show up to vote when this is a North Korean-style election. You got one person on the ballot, essentially. You know, yep. And Nikki Haley was there. She doesn't even want to show her face now. She's embarrassed herself so badly with all this stuff.
There was some good in that. I mean, you know, I find Nikki Haley to be almost as repellent as the Orange Man, so it was happy to see her exit stage left.
That's right. Oh, I was very concerned when she jumped into the race that she is a dangerous demagogue. I thought it was really funny when she was trying to, endear herself to the people in New Hampshire. She started criticizing the people in South Carolina as a bunch of knuckle-dragging racists who had elected her twice to governorship. And I thought, the next one she's got to do is she's got to go to these people she accused of being a backward racist.
The fascinating thing about Haley to me is that, you know, ostensibly we are supposed to have representatives in our democracy, right? Meaning, you know, ostensibly people who have been approved of by at least a putative majority of the voters. Well, this woman has been repudiated by just astounding tsunami margins of contempt, and she won't get the hint, you know, until today. You know, we don't want you. Nobody wants you. Literally, go away. Yeah. She has the arrogance and the effrontery to countermand the clearly expressed will of the people and say, no, you're going to have me regardless. I'm going to force myself upon you because, you know, I'm the right person for the job.
Well, you know, she's got all these donors. And I remember when I was working with the Libertarian Party, the first thing they would ask if you got an interview with some reporter, so what is your campaign budget? In other words, how much money are you going to spend advertising with us, right? And so she's got lots of money to throw at people. So that makes her a legitimate candidate because she's already been bought.
Yes, exactly.
I called her Nuki.
Somebody came up with this. I wish I could remember who it was. It was during the pandemic, air fingers quotes, when they said, you know, we really ought to have some kind of a law or regulation that requires people like Fauci and people like Haley to do kind of like the NASCAR drivers do and wear the patches of their sponsors on the chest.
Yeah, they'd have to get bigger suits, I think.
Yep.
Yeah, I called her Nuki Haley because she never saw, like Lindsey Graham, she never saw war. She didn't like, what is it about South Carolina? And I've asked that question. I've had people in South Carolina respond and say, you know, it's the part, it's not the rank and file Republicans in South Carolina. We don't like these people any more than you do. Yeah. It's the party that's got control of it. And, you know, that's the real issue, isn't it? With our elections, when everybody was complaining about what Trump did in terms of locking everybody down and said, okay, now you're going to vote by mail. And then he had the audacity to complain about the results that he got. You know, we all knew that. But I said, if you want to talk about election corruption, talk about ballot access, you know, because that's where the corruption begins right there. They're going to say nobody gets on the ballot unless they are part of these two parties. And then they can control very easily within their party who gets on the ballot. So they make sure that it's only going to be people who are the establishment. And that's what we're always going to have as long as we've got that duopoly running all of that stuff. But of course, what's changed in all of that this time around is the fact that the Democrats are no longer happy with a duopoly. They got to have a monopoly. And so they want to get the Orange Man off the ballot. And now everybody has discovered ballot access. What a surprise. But they're not talking about doing any reform for anybody other than Trump, are they?
No, and it's necessary to maintain the illusion of consent. They had elections in the Soviet Union under Stalin because, again, they had to create this fiction that somehow he had been approved of by the majority of the people in the Soviet Union. You know, so and in a number of other countries, they require people to vote. Why is that? Yeah. Why would they require people to vote? Because they require the illusion of consent.
Yeah. It's very important. And that's why, you know, we look at Super Tuesday and they've got for Biden, where he's got no opposition at all. They made sure in Florida, you know, that they kicked off any of the people who are going to run against him. And the DNC in Florida said, no, we're only going to have Biden on. And the political party has the power to do that kind of stuff. And so we really do have a Stalin-esque election. And you got all CNN and Fox News are all treating this as if there was some kind of a serious election. There's no debates. There's no discussion about issues. It's simply about personalities, and it's about lawfare and all the rest of this stuff. Nothing at all about issues, is it?
And there's never none of the above.
Yes.
You know, if we had that option in the election, then we would have elections, because then a majority of people could say, you know, both of these two candidates of the major parties are despicable and I want nothing to do with either of them. So none of the above. And if 70 or even 60% of the people had checked none of the above, okay, well, we have to somehow figure something else out and at least get less loathsome candidates out there that could perhaps at least get a degree of approval from the bulk of the people. But in our democracy, we can't have that option, can we?
No. Well, there was an uncommitted in one of these recent ones, and that got a substantial number of votes. And I guess when people saw uncommitted on there, I guess they thought that was a description of all the candidates. They're uncommitted to anything except to themselves. You know, they don't have any commitments, no principles, nothing.
But, you know, it's we were talking a little bit about my article on the subject of voting. It's such a tough nut, you know, for me as I like to think, a principled libertarian. I understand and I have great sympathy for the argument that voting in any context is almost a dirty act. You know, you're endorsing this system in a way, right? Mm-hmm. You're helping to legitimize it. But then I think to myself, you know, we're all under duress. It's not as though we have free choice. It's not as though we can say, you know, I want nothing to do with this and have that vote count in a meaningful sense. So is it wrong to use the vote or see the vote, I'll put it that way, as a kind of a defensive measure? You know, in the sense that if I vote for more freedom to the extent that that's possible, it countermands the vote of the neighbor down the street who wants less freedom from me. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing. And I also don't think it's necessarily incongruent with continuing to advocate for the ideal, for the best. You know, you hope for the best, you want the best. You never cease advocating for the best. But at the same time, you do what you can to make things a little bit better. And that might make me a libertarian apostate in this case. Yeah. I don't know. I think this is firmly cemented on the point. But, you know, I'm exasperated by it. I don't know what to do. So it seems to me that doing both is not necessarily an unreasonable thing.
Well, you know, what I've been trying to tell people is forget about Washington. And I say forget about the presidency. I say forget about Senate and Congress. But pay very much attention, a great deal of attention, to who's running locally and at the state level. Because you can have a lot more effect there. And, you know, Soros has been doing that by pouring money into state attorney general races, pouring a lot of money into local district attorney races. And look at how he has been able to affect change in California. Destroying it, of course. Yeah. But that's his purpose. You know, Soros is about chaos. And so, you know, but he's been very effective at that. And Elon Musk said, you have to understand that's really genius because you're going to have so much more effect at the local level. First of all, you're one of maybe even just a few hundred people who vote in some aspect of it, as opposed to one of hundreds of millions of people who may vote in an election. You know, so anything that you do, whether it's your vote or whether it's working for a candidate or whether it is, supporting a candidate financially or something, any of that is going to have a lot more effect. And as we saw in 2020, these people have a lot more effect on your life even than the governor or the president or certainly the Congress, because they can make things a lot better or even a lot worse, depending on that. So I think there's a real strong case to be made still for being involved in local elections. Maybe, you know, in your local election, you still don't have a good candidate. You've got a better chance of trying to get somebody in there as a good local candidate for a local election than you do off of the state and especially off of the federal. And yet we have all of our attention is upside down. And it's that way because the national press has pushed us to do that. The government has pushed us to do that because they know that that is futile. Really, you know, that whole voting thing is futile. And, you know, when we talk about voting, going back to my experience with the Libertarian Party, that was always what we did. We always focused and spent all of our time trying to get ballot access. And then they wouldn't let us into the debates, even after we jumped through extra hoops. But they were expert at getting on the ballot. And so now you've got RFK Jr. who's looking at this and saying, well, you know, these people, they know how to get on the ballot. That's one thing they can accomplish. Maybe I can get a spot on the ballot. What do you think about that? What do you think about RFK Jr. running as a Libertarian candidate?
Well, I want to talk about two things. First, I think your initial point is very well said and well put. You know, the left understands that. They have been working at the local level and from the local level up for the past 50 years, you know, like termites burrowing into a tree, and people haven't noticed it until, boom, all of a sudden it seems that the authoritarian left controls the entire country and everything, you know? Mm-hmm. So certainly we can take a page from their playbook and do the same thing. You know, you as you say, in your local community, not only are the numbers smaller, but you know these people. You know, you will never know your congressman or your senator, let alone the president. Mm-hmm. You know, this might be the guy who lives down the road, and you might have known this guy for the last 20 years. So you can approach that person and talk to them, and there's that human connection that simply doesn't exist when we're talking about national level politics. So there's that point. As far as RFK Jr., you know, there are aspects of RFK Jr. that I don't like, but there are many aspects of him that I do like, chief of which he seems to be a sane person. He seems to be a sane, intelligent person, a person that you can have a conversation with. You know, I think he's taken a number of stands that are very positive, particularly with regard to the menacing influence of big corporations, and particularly these pharmaceutical corporations, over the government, over the country. And yeah, by any hook or crook, I'd like to see him get on the ballot. However he can do it would be great, obviously. And interestingly to me, the Democrat Party has repudiated the scion of the Kennedy family, of all people. You know, they despise him, and they despise him because he's kind of an honest leftist, you know, in that he actually does believe in free speech. He actually does believe in the traditional core Democrat liberal ideas of the 60s. And that kind of makes him a right winger by today's standards.
Yeah, you know, when he first announced, I said, well, you know, I really like what he has had to say about the COVID vaccine and some of the other things like that. But he has made it clear that he and his family are all vaccinated and, you know, tried to carve this out. And I think is a little bit too clever by half. And it kind of, you know, eroded my trust of what he was actually saying by saying, well, I just want to have, you know, clean vaccines and safe vaccines. I'm not against vaccines and all the rest of the stuff. I am against vaccines. And, you know, for all of these reasons, and I would have thought that he would say that. But the other thing that bothered me was the fact that, you know, he has always been a diehard climate MacGuffin guy.
Yes.
And, you know, the comment that he made, and nobody called him on it for the longest time, and he wouldn't come on my show, even to talk about his book, which the one that he did on Fauci, I thought was good, because it was, you know, he talked in his, toward the end of the book, he talked about Dark Winter and all the stuff that laid the foundation where they practiced. It wasn't just Event 201. It goes back to Dark Winter 2 months before 9/11. So this is something that was rehearsed. He talked about all the CIA connections, that Fauci had and all the rest of the stuff. I thought it was very good. I wanted to talk to him about that. But he, you know, we booked it and then he canceled at the last minute. So, you know, I don't know. He doesn't like me, and that's not why I'm pulling back from it. When he started to run, I wanted to ask him, you know, with all the censorship stuff that he had, he's had some great things to say about censorship and how bad it is. And yet he was calling for censorship when he said that they needed to arrest and jail the people who were skeptics of this climate change agenda.
Well, he did walk that back, but I remember him saying that.
Yeah. And when he walked it back, he gave essentially a lie, you know, in terms of walking it back. What he said was, I was talking about the corporation. No, you don't lock up a corporation and you don't give it three hots and a cot. You're talking about the people, you know, and nobody pushed him on that. But, you know, it really, he did go on to say, I would give the corporations a death sentence. Now, I agree that when we have these corporations that are doing things like this, like, you know, the banks like JP Morgan that's been convicted so many times, or HSBC that's got this long criminal conviction thing, they ought to be given a death sentence. But instead, they're declared to be too big to jail. So I don't have a problem with giving corporations a death sentence, but I do have a problem with the fact that he won't really walk that back. It would have been a useful and honest thing for him to say, you know, I used to think that we ought to censor our opponents, but now since it's happened to me, I don't support that anymore because I've learned from it. Nobody wants to admit to a mistake anymore.
No. And I think also people are really thirsty in that they're desperate for somebody who's at least kind of an operational human being, you know, as opposed to, we've literally got this senile old grifter who can barely follow a teleprompter anymore, right, on the one hand. And then you've got this sloganeering demagogue on the other side.
Yeah.
And their conversation operates at the level of a not particularly bright 8-year-old, if that. And so I think anybody who just wants to have somebody who can complete a sentence, let alone a paragraph, that seems intelligible, you know, finds RFK immensely appealing despite all of these issues that he has.
And so they will fight like the devil to keep him out of the debates, even if he gets on with the Libertarian Party. And they're pretty good at getting on the ballot in all 50 states. Even if he gets on with them, they will keep him out of the debates. And as I said, you know, from the very beginning, I said, it'll be interesting. I said, I don't support him, but it would be great to have him in the debates because we could finally have somebody talking about issues. If you got even just the dynamics, you know, of having having three different candidates up there, then you can't do this thing. Well, this guy's evil and I'm, you know, not as bad as he is. And the fact that he wants to talk about issues, that would completely change the dynamics. It's one of the reasons why they'll do anything they can to keep him out of the debates. They will not allow that. The debates have been run for so long by the two parties, and they're not going to open that up. So we're not really going to have, you know, a discussion of the issues. But it is an interesting interesting idea. You got another article, Anticipating Government.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that. What do you anticipate government doing?
And what do? You know, I've been involved in the car business now for writing about the car industry and motoring and all of that for more than 30 years. So I've acquired some perspective over that time. And when I first began covering the industry back in the 90s, at that time, the car industry was still kind of oppositionally defiant toward the regulatory apparatus.
Yes.
You know, when the government would come out with a proposed regulation, and the good example of this being the original airbag mandate when that first came out. And I was privy to this. I was involved in this at the time in the sense that I covered it and I knew some of the people who were involved in it. The major car companies sent their engineers to go speak with the regulators at NHTSA and they told them, look, you know, these airbags that you're expecting us to put in these cars are potentially dangerous. They're going to hurt older people. They're going to hurt children. Here's why. And they presented them with all the data and all the facts. Didn't matter. The government went ahead and mandated it anyway. And so I think the lesson that they took from that is that it's better to go along and get along. And so ever since that time, not only have they ceased fighting anything the regulatory apparatus comes out with, they anticipate regulations now. And a good way to understand that is look at the new car market right now. We hear about Joe Biden's requirement that comes into effect in 2026 about the kill switch and the technology that's going to be necessary to make that happen. Mm-hmm. Almost all new cars already have that technology. Well before the mandate came down from the federal government. And why is that? Because the auto industry anticipated it and they want to profit from it. They figure, well, you know, this is going to happen. Let's get ahead of it. Let's just go ahead and put it in the cars. We'll charge people for it. And potentially we can make money down the road in one way or another via this system. So now they've become even worse than the government in a sense, in that they're looking around for all the ways that they can come up with things that they know the regulatory apparatus will like, that they can then force you and I to pay for if we want to have a new car.
Oh, yeah. And it's very much like the ESG stuff, right? These people want to, not only do they want to anticipate it from a financial standpoint, but they know that they want to team up with the government. And that's one of the key things, I think. You know, when we look at Reason and Cato Institute, when they're looking at censorship, for example, when they were covering this last week, Eric, they had arguments. Both Florida and Texas had put in some restrictions for social media companies about censorship. And the way Reason looked at it, they're still back to the idea that, you can't censor these private companies. I said, you know, there's this idea from libertarians that companies can do nothing wrong and that government can do nothing right. Just the opposite of what the left is about, that government can do nothing wrong and companies can do nothing right. But what both of them miss is the fact that they have merged together. That's what you're talking about. Two of them have merged together. It is a kind of fascism. We have this, crony capitalism that's running out there. And ESG, you know, which is, okay, so if we're in the environment and for societal governance, we're all going to cooperate and we're going to run this stuff through from the corporations. I think that's a large part of it. And as you've talked about, it's because they want the concession when they stop selling cars and they're selling mobility. They want the government to give them, make them one of the approved rent-a-ride places.
Well, libertarians who defend corporate privilege in the context of free markets fascinates me, because corporations are creatures of government.
Yes.
They're really government chartered enterprises that are given special legal privileges that individuals don't have, while at the same time also being accorded the same protections legally that a human individual would have. Mm-hmm. So it's a really silly argument in my view that, you know, somehow these corporations are entitled to that kind of deference. And I think it's less fascistic than Soviet, what we're dealing with right now. You know, the Soviet Union, you had these planned economies. You had the big state industries that operated in tandem with the state, you know, to produce whatever they decided between the two of them was going to be out there, whatever it was, irrespective of any demand. This EV thing is an excellent case in point. There is no market for these things, no significant market. There would be no EVs, except perhaps very, very small niche products. You know, literally a handful, maybe a few hundred of them built in total. Mm-hmm. If it were not for this Soviet cooperation between the regulatory state and the corporate state, you know, the corporations that are in bed with this. And I'm getting a little bit of Schadenfreude satisfaction out of the collapse of the EV market, such as it is. I'm enjoying this tremendously, you know, as the whole thing comes apart. And I draw a parallel with what happened with these vaccines, the beautiful vaccines that Trump gave us. It's following that same trajectory. You know, they pushed them on people first very aggressively. They did it with a lot of dishonesty. You know, they used terms that were specifically designed to mislead people. They prevented people from knowing the facts, the truth. But, you know, inevitably the truth does come out. Mm-hmm. You know, and once the truth begins to come out, after a while it kind of takes on a sort of kinetic energy, and there's a critical mass moment where all of a sudden it just kind of, people get it. This is a bad idea. I'm not going to have anything to do with it. Mm-hmm. And that's why Ford, for example, has had to stop shipping the 2024 Lightning, its electric F-150, because there are so many 2023 Lightnings just sitting around on dealers' lots that they can't get rid of the things. Yeah. It's why Nissan has had to slash prices on its Ariya EV. It's why all the other manufacturers are flailing about trying to figure out, what are we going to do? We hug the tar baby. How do we get out of the tar baby's embrace?
I love to, you know, you call Polestar Polecat, and their CEO out there was taunting the marketplace, saying, you people are just afraid of change. And it's like, we don't want your product. Don't you get it? I mean, you know, it's like, I'm going to tell you what you need to buy, and you need to go out there and buy it. And if you don't, you're a scaredy cat. You know, it's like, oh, really?
I got into a back and forth on my site with somebody who took issue with an article that I'd written about the EVs and said something to the effect about, you know, you're defending obsolete technology. And, you know, I was able to dive on that with both feet. Mm-hmm. Obsolete technology, actually, it's the EV that's the obsolete technology. And it was declared obsolete 100 years ago by the free market when we still had one, because 100 years ago, combustion engine cars proved themselves to be the superior alternative. And that's why EVs stopped being made 100 years ago. And the only reason they're being made now is because we no longer have a free market.
That's right. Yeah, everybody got all excited about that documentary. Whatever happened to the electric car? Well, now we know. Now everybody knows.
I drove that. I drove the GM EV1 back in the 90s.
Did you really?
I was driving cars back then. So what was it like? I can give you expert testimony because I did it. It's the same thing. 30 years, you know, 30 years in the rear view. It was the same thing. It was limited range, high cost, and all the hassles, you know, of having to plan your life around recharging this thing. Mm-hmm. Nothing has significantly improved other than, well, they've managed to get more power into the battery somehow. And they, you know, the electric motors are stronger than they were. So that's why they constantly talk about how quick and, you know, speedy these things are. And, you know, the thing about that I point out to EV people, you know, how long do you think it's going to be if you're, you know, if this thing does succeed and they manage to make, you know, make the EV the dominant vehicle on the road, do you think a point's going to come when all of a sudden they're going to say, you know, we can't allow these ludicrously speedy vehicles to be loosed on the public roads? And then they're going to install speed limiters. They're already talking about that.
Oh, yeah.
So what will happen then is you'll be driving around in your $80,000 EV that's limited to the same speed that an 86 Yugo GV was capable of. I'm looking forward to that.
It'll be like the little golf carts that everybody was riding around in the prisoner in the village, right? That's basically the mode of transportation we're going to. And of course, he's got the new Roadster out. It's going to do 0 to 60 in 1 second. I don't know if my heart could stand that kind of acceleration or not. But as what's the point of that? As you point out, they're not going to let people do that. There's speed bumps and all the rest of this stuff. I mean, cameras everywhere, speed cameras, speed bumps. They're not going to allow that.
not only what's the point of it, after a while it's just boring because it's all the same. There's no variety here. You know, it's just okay, it's really quick, but whoop-de-doo. Mm-hmm. You know, I put something up on the site this morning about this new battery powered charger that Dodge just revealed, the replacement for the Hemi V8 powered charger and Challenger. And again, it's just this kind of embarrassing confession in that they're trying so hard to give people what they want by giving people something that's different than what they want. This is, it looks like a muscle car. They call it a muscle car, and it even makes fake muscle car sounds. They have some kind of a sound generating thing in it that reproduces the sound of a V8 engine, and it gets better. It even shakes and vibrates, you know, to give you the fake impression that you've got an engine under the hood. And I'm thinking to myself, I mean, nobody who wants a muscle car wants that. So what are they trying to do here?
Yeah. I guess they could put a fake scoop in it so you can have a shaker hood and all the rest of
it. One of my readers, and I wish I had thought of this because it's absolutely brilliant. I had to like sit and laugh about it for a few minutes. And they said, you know, what they should do is come up with the sound of gas pumping at these electric fast chargers. So you can sit and listen to it for like the gas and air fingers quotes flowing for the 45 minutes while you wait to get a partial charge.
Well, at least it now really does match the name. It's now become a charger. And you're going to be spending most of your time at the charger with your charger trying to get this thing loaded if you even can during the winter. I mean, that's the funny thing about it. It really now is literally a charger after all these years.
It's such a tragic thing. You know, they have tried very hard, and it's a good looking car in my opinion. You know, it's not that it's ugly. It's just that it's stupid. What's the point of this? Mm-hmm. And you know, and of course they've been developing it for the last couple of years. And so in the interval, the truth has leaked out about EVs, and you know, now people know. You know, and this is going to, in my opinion, this is going to be it for Dodge. I think this is going to kill them.
Wow. Well, you know, you go back and you look at the first Tesla. Now he's got this one that does 0-60 in 1 second, he says. Yeah. You go back and you look at the first Roadster that they came out with. And I remember when Top Gear and Jeremy Clarkson had it out there and they tried to take it around the track. But immediately it ran out of juice, you know, because they were really slamming the thing. And, and he just went off on him. They came after him for slander or defamation or something like that, didn't they?
Oh, by the way, you reminded me of something that bears on that. So guess how much this charger, the electric charger, weighs?
Oh, how much?
Just shy of 3 tons before you get in.
Before you get in. Yeah. And of course, today with the weight, general weight of the public, that takes
and now, interestingly enough, that's why it's not particularly fast. You know, they talk about how quick it is, but its top speed is only 134 miles an hour, which is, you know, that's kind of pathetic. Last summer, I got to drive the last of the Challenger Hellcats, the Black Ghost Edition. That thing would do more than 200 miles an hour. Wow. And because it didn't weigh 3 tons, as you know, the faster you go, you need more and more power to continue to push through the wind and get that thing going. So you've got a vehicle that isn't particularly fast. And if you were to drive it even partially that fast, you get out on the highway and drive that battery powered device at 80 miles an hour, let's say, which isn't that fast. I mean, most freeway traffic now is moving at 70, 75 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. Your range is going to take a dump. You know, and then you're going to be listening to the fake sounds of gas pumping at the fast charger
for half a day.
Right.
That you're trying to charge this thing up. Well, you know, the weight is a big issue. And of course, they can't get around the laws of thermodynamics and physics with the weight. No. And so it affects everything. It affects your performance in terms of anything other than straight line acceleration. That's the key thing that I like. I like to have a light car. You know, that was the big appealing thing about Lotus, you know. You know, his slogan was to add lightness. And so, you know, minimize the weight. And now they've just completely lost that, to the extent that this study that was done a couple of years ago, Wall Street Journal has pulled it out, said because of the weight, you're going through more brake, generating more brake dust and wearing your brakes down and wearing your tires out and all this other kind of stuff. So you think about those things as emissions. Their only response was, well, okay, yeah, but maybe it doesn't weigh that much more than an SUV or whatever. But they're talking about electrifying everything. And so they're talking about electrifying the SUVs. They're talking about electrifying the semi-trailers and everything. So everything gets heavier. And they're not even talking about what happens to our roads, what happens to parking garages that are going to have to be redesigned and all the rest of the stuff. None of it makes any sense, except you and I know, and talked about this for years, that the end game for all of this MacGuffin, they've got one thing that they want, and that is to essentially take away all private transportation. That's the end game.
Sure. That's why all these EVs get a pass on so many fronts. And, you know, the business with the weight, there's another thing that starts with W, and it's waste. You know, all of that weight, think about all the materials that go into a 3-ton vehicle, like this device that Dodge just put out, and the raw materials that have to be pulled out of the earth and then manufactured, refined, processed, what have you, into this vehicle. I've read studies that indicate that the typical EV consumes twice as much raw materials and energy as a comparable, otherwise comparable gas engine car. It's disgusting. Yeah. And they're also energy hogs. You know, think about how much electricity it takes to rocket one of these things to 60 in 2 or 3 seconds or whatever it is and cart around the 3 tons meanwhile. And they have the audacity, to preen as being green. Yeah. And it's just an astounding thing. And I think it relies chiefly on this orchestrated campaign of preventing people from knowing the truth. I tell people when I talk to them, just random people, about, did you know that, for example, this Charger weighs nearly 3 tons? In other words, it weighs nearly as much. This passenger car, you look at the silhouette, it's not that big of a car. It's slightly bigger than a Toyota Avalon, let's say. But it has a curb weight that's comparable to a current 1500 Chevy dually pickup truck. Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you point out, it's the energy. It's the energy. However, you got something that is really heavy and you're going to hurtle it down the road at this ludicrous speed. And yet look at the amount of energy that's going to be consumed. Where's that going to come from? The EPA is out there shutting down power plants, just like they want to shut down people turbocharging their cars. It's absolutely insane. But we were talking earlier about the similarity between what was happening with the COVID stuff. And I talk about it as being a MacGuffin. They'll sell you some kind of a Maltese Falcon or something, right? But they've got this end, the end of it is already in mind. And ultimately, when you get all the way to the end, it's about taking everything away from you, locking you down with surveillance and control. But just like it was with this supposed pandemic, this supposed climate change thing, they've got one solution that you're allowed to have. And even when people come up with a different solution, they won't allow it. And so it's kind of interesting to see what is happening in that regard, I think, with Toyota, because Toyota has kind of gone their own way. They've tried now a couple of different approaches. It's kind of like when people offered ivermectin and zinc or HCQ and zinc or ivermectin. And it's going to be interesting to see if these dictators are going to allow that. They've got a couple of different solutions. They said, well, why don't we do an electric car that is hydrogen fuel based? Or why don't we have, and the latest one is to come out and say, well, we're going to scoop up CO2. We're going to separate, as the car is moving along, we're going to scoop up the CO2. We're going to extract that. We're going to liquefy that and turn it into an e-fuel. I wonder if they're going to let them do that. What's going to be their rationale to say, no, you can't do that, that engineering solution?
Yeah, I'm very happy the direction that Toyota has decided to pursue, because I consider Toyota to be kind of analogous to Florida during the height of the pandemic.
Yeah.
That you break the narrative by showing an alternative that's more effective and reasonable, and that helps to bring sanity back to the table. So they have been very astute in not buying into this whole EV juggernaut. They've committed heavily to hybrids, which make all kinds of sense. I have no problem with hybrids, leaving aside the whole climate change MacGuffin. There's nothing wrong with a Toyota Prius that can get to 60 in 6 seconds and gives you close to 60 miles per gallon. That's that's excellent. I'm all for that. I think that's great. A very useful and practical car. And so they have focused on making vehicles like that. And without really saying it out loud, they're just kind of like, okay, we're going to continue to make vehicles people want, and we'll let the chips fall where they may, and let our rivals go out of business, I think, ultimately, is what's going to happen here.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it'll be interesting because, if they push back against that, one of the things during this pandemic, and we're getting up to the 4-year anniversary of this thing, one of the things was that you saw a lot of people who had been in the medical field, and as they, they're sold this agenda, oh, we got a pandemic, and this new novel pandemic. And they said, oh, okay, they believed them. And then they said, but why don't we do this instead? Because what you're talking about doing, this might work better. That's, I don't think, going to work. And they immediately get shut down. And then they realize, wait a minute, there's something else happening here. And then eventually they wake up to the fact, oh, there's not even really a pandemic. That might be the best possible outcome to this. Is that people go down the same path. You have the engineers at Toyota say, prove to people that their real concern was never about CO2 or anything else like that. It was always just about control, because they won't accept these other alternatives. And these other alternatives that Toyota is coming up with are unacceptable to them, because they have to have you charging something off of their power grid as they're shutting the power grid down.
Exactly. And, by the way, and this, I think, speaks to the broader point, they're not even allowing the affordable in-city kind of city suburban small EVs that are available in China into this country. Now, if we're in a climate crisis, wouldn't you want people to, you know, to, by whatever means necessary, this is a good basic transportation device. Lots of people can afford an $8,000 or $9,000 city car. But they won't allow that. That's fascinating to me. Why won't they do it? You know, they talk about, well, they don't meet current federal safety guidelines. Well, wait a minute. You're telling me there's an existential threat. The climate is in crisis. And we're all going to die, you know, unless we reduce our carbon footprint. And yet, you know, you're talking about, well, you know, if you drive this thing, if you have an accident, if you get hit a certain way, you might get hurt. That somehow takes more priority over this supposed existential crisis. It doesn't compute. It just does not make any sense until you realize that, yeah, the end goal is not about climate change. It's about impoverishing all of us and controlling all of us. That is the end point of all of this.
That's right. And a lot of the climate alarmists who believe all of this stuff, when you had the Paris Climate Accord, which is a treaty, when that was self-ratified by John Kerry and the Republicans let him get away with that ruse, and Trump did throughout his administration as well. But you know, when they came up with this Paris climate thing, the people who really believed in that were outraged. They said, how can you allow the two biggest countries, China and India, to continue with this? And so it exposed to them the fact that they're not talking about global climate change due to CO2. They're not concerned about that at all. This is really simply about redistributing wealth. You know, from the countries where it is right now, the United States, Europe, and things like that, to China, because these people gotten in on the ground floor with these communist thugs who are running their economy there.
Yeah, a good way, when you hear the word carbon being bandied about by these people, just think of energy.
Yeah.
What they want to do is impose energy scarcity, which, you know, is a way of culling population at the end of the day. You know, if you can't eat, if you can't keep warm, you know, that is ultimately going to have health consequences. And that's ultimately what they want. That's the end game here. And I think it's difficult for most people to imagine, because it really is. It's incredibly malicious. It's unbelievably dark. You know, it's kind of like, I'm sure that the people who are lining up for the boxcars, you know, to be transported to the east to be resettled, had difficulty believing that they were actually being put onto a boxcar and you know, being sent off to their doom. Mm-hmm. But the situation, I think, is quite comparable.
Yeah, normal people always underestimate the evil of these psychopaths. And they also underestimate their technology that they've got as well. You have an article we probably have about a year, and it's it goes down the professional wrestling theme, which is really appropriate now. Tell us a little bit about that. But what do you think is going to happen in the interim?
Well, it was kind of a thought experiment. You know, I'm just kind of trying to play out, or game, as they put it, these various scenarios. And one scenario that comes to mind in this, you know, opera bouffe or WWE wrestling match that we have between the Orange Man and the Senile Man, is that they actually are going to let the Orange Man win, and then they're going to tank the economy, and then there's going to be some other awful thing that goes on, so that they can pin the tail on the orange donkey. Mm. And not just on him. Then they'll be able to frame it as, look at all these awful white nationalist MAGA supporting people who brought this terrible, terrible man into office. And we have got to do something about that. Mm. And we all know what they're going to do about that. So that's one of the things that concerns me. Now, the only a silver lining to that dark cloud is we have about a year to prepare and get ready. You know, consider it a gift of time to shore things up in your personal otherwise, to get ready for what's probably coming.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, the question is, you know, is Biden going to get desperate enough to win that he's going to pull something in the election year? Mm-hmm. Because, and I've said this to people, I said, that's a possibility. But the other part of it is that once, you know, if Trump gets in, or if Biden gets reelected, they're definitely going to pull something next year. I absolutely believe that. And one of the reasons I believe it, Eric, is because of this fourth turning thing in the time frame. They all keep talking about 2030. Everything is 2030. That's when they want to have their new society in. And they all talk about millennials and all of these other labels that Strauss and Howe used when they talked about the fourth turning and about generations. But they don't want to talk about the other part of it. But they do talk about these dates. And so I think they're very well aware of that, and they want to exploit that. And they're going to have to get all of that done in the next presidential term is when this is all going to go through. Let me read you a couple of comments here from people. Amos Poole, thank you very much for the tip. He said, I picked up a low mileage 1997 Mustang Cobra manual transmission. Fun to drive, no computer BS. tried the 67, which is a more beautiful classic, but it was like driving a truck. Not easy, smooth drive. As a matter of fact, I had a 68 Mustang, and I know exactly what you're talking about. I made the mistake of changing the steering wheel, making it even smaller, and putting bigger tires on it. So I took something that wasn't already handling very well and really ruined it. Mentioning while you have Eric on, love his perspective on that. What do you think about that 97 Mustang Cobra?
I love the car. You know, I got to drive that when it was new. And one of the striking things about it to me is that, okay, 1997, how long ago is that? 30 years almost, right?
Yeah.
And how much has improved since then? You know, I have a 22-year-old truck, and I get in it, and I turn the key. It's electronically fuel-injected. It starts immediately. Its drivability is better than the new cars because it doesn't have all of this additional complexity that's built into it. So what have we gotten? What has improved? And, you know, that's a fascinating thing to me. It used to be that there was this linear progression. You know, the reason that people bought new cars every few years was because the new car was better. It offered things that were, you know, that were advantageous relative to the old car. You went from 6 volts to 12 volts. You went from bias ply to radial tires, transmissions without overdrive to a transmission with overdrive, carburetors to fuel injection. All of these things were good and beneficial. Now people are realizing all I'm getting with the new car is the sticker shock. I'm getting this expensive, overteched thing that is controlling me and parenting me and data mining me that I don't even potentially own because like somebody can just shut it off remotely.
That's
so,
right.
You know, what do you get? I mean, that's a metric of things have not really progressed much in any meaningfully good way since the 90s.
And of course, that sticker shock is almost like the Milgram experiment, you know. But, you know, even before that, I remember when I was growing up as a kid, and I really wasn't paying attention to performance, but they weren't either. It was all about styling. And one comment here from Birdhouse Blue says, I can't even tell the make and the model of today's cars because they all look so much alike. They don't even bother to look at anything like that. And they're all the same color, essentially. They're all some, you know, shade of gray.
White or silver or gray.
What's
and, you know, there's actually white or silver or gray. And I found out, you know, inadvertently, I found out why that is because I wondered about that. I thought, well, how comes, why is it so many people are choosing to buy a vehicle that looks like a refrigerator? And I, the reason why, in thumbing through some of the paperwork that I get with the new vehicles that I test drive, is that the manufacturers are now charging extra for the colors. You know, if you want to get, you know, if you want to get something other than white, silver, or black, you're going to end up paying $800 more. And so a lot of people are just skipping that. As far as why they all look the same, it's because the government is designing cars now, not the manufacturers. The regulations now have set forth effectively a template. People who follow NASCAR racing will know what I'm talking about. Like, there's literally a template that the car has to fit order for it to be qualified to be on the track. Mm-hmm. And effectively, the regulations have done just the same with car design. They have to meet, you know, these same standards for things like bumper impact, side impact, and so on. And that necessarily winnows and funnels the design down to this basic blob shape that you're seeing everywhere, this crossover blob shape. And I've got I put up a picture on the site that shows it's got to be at least a dozen different makes and models of crossover that all look the same. And you just can't tell what they are unless you can find the badge somewhere.
That's an interesting insight because like it is like NASCAR. When I talk about the colors of the cars, I kind of joke. I said, you know, back in the 50s, the TVs were all black and white and the cars were in Technicolor. And now it's just the opposite. way around, except that you have to, just like you had to pay extra to get a color TV in the 60s when that came around, you got to pay extra to get a color car. So
it's dreary. And again, to put it in stark relief, if you go to it, it's getting to be spring and summer, go to a car show, you know, an old car show, and just look at the profusion of difference, the wild styling that used to be common. You know, even among economy cars, you saw these quirky little things that they would do with them that you never see anymore. They're all just the same. And, you know, that's just taking all the emotion and passion out of cars. Because like I say, it literally is an appliance now. It's like you're buying it for...
Yes, it is. And I remember, you know, as a kid, it was always an interesting thing that, you know, the use of chrome and the use of fins, and some of the stuff was really hideous and some of it was like really cool. And it was always, so what are they going to do next? I mean, and they were trying all kinds of stuff, you know, and then in the, you know, late 60s and early 70s, it became about improvements to performance and stuff like that. But when I was a kid, it was all about appearance. And as a kid, you could certainly, you know, appreciate that and understand that. But again, today, it's just like you should point out, it's the government designing cars, and we're winding up with is a lot of Ladas, just like straight out.
And another thing that's happened too that's interesting to me is that in the luxury car segment, because of the regulations, they are now the same extruded plastic blobs that the inexpensive cars are. It used to be that if you bought a high-end car, luxury car, it had beautiful chrome, you know, multi-plate chrome, and it had real metal finishes on the inside, things like that. Now, I mean, I was driving out the other day, and I looked at happened to be near a new Land Rover, and adjacent to the new Land Rover was a Honda CR-V. I mean, not much difference between the two. They both had these, they call them fascias, you know, these plastic, huge, bulbous, kind of Oprah Winfrey looking rear end treatments, and the same on the front, plastic everywhere. You know, you get inside the vehicle, even a six figure car, like a, you know, Mercedes, you get into a six figure Mercedes. And what do you see? You see a cheap made in China LCD touchscreen, you know, and 6 or 7 years ago, that was kind of provocative because nobody else had that back then. Now everybody has it. You get into a $20,000 Hyundai or Kia, and it too has a big touchscreen. So what are you getting for your, you know, you're getting for $100,000, you're getting a big plastic three-pointed star in your grill.
Yeah, that's right. And I really hate those touchscreens because, you know, it takes your eye off the, all these people say, well, it's distracted driving. We're going to give you a fine if you're using a cell phone. It's like, there's nothing more distracting than trying to use a touchscreen as you're bumping around and trying to drive, and you got to stare at this thing. Yeah, it's just, it's the worst thing because, you know, if you got a, you know, the old style cars, you had something that was tactile. You know, once you located where that knob was, you could twist it while you're paying attention to your driving. It is a really dangerous and distracting idea. And yet, the government is pretty much mandating that while it is punishing people for doing the same thing with their phone.
Well, and the reason that they're doing that is because, again, the long-term agenda is for you to not be a driver, you to be a passenger, and then it won't matter. And then, you know, you've got to keep the passenger busy, right? So now he's got the touchscreen to play with, you know, while he's being transported from A to B, assuming, of course, he has a good social credit score.
You got an article talking about good social credit score. You got an article, Bot Life, where you chime in on what happened with Gemini this last week. Give us your take on that.
Well, it was interesting. And I don't know whether you've experienced this, but I've spoken with a number of other people who write and have had, for want of a better word, a bot attack. You write an article that challenges a narrative, whatever it might be, whether it has to do with the vaccines or the electric cars or Orange Man or whatever. And in your comments section of your website, you'll get these, they have a weird cadence, a strange mannerism, an odd way of putting things that just kind of recites narrative talking points. And I'm convinced it's a bot. I mean, I may be getting paranoid, but I don't believe so. I think that these are AIs that are sent out there, kind of like in the movie, and those little things would be out there spinning around and trying to get at things. And I think Discord, you know, and they're trying to break up the conversation on the facts to present these narrative points of view. You can still identify them, I think, just by the awkwardisms and the incongruities that you'll see that a normal human being wouldn't speak that way. At least I don't think so.
Yeah. And of course, you know, when you look at Gemini, and I talked about this last week, Matt Taibbi said, as everybody was talking about this ridiculous, you know, cultural misappropriation, I guess we could call it, you know, when they say, show me an American Revolutionary soldier or somebody from 17th century Scotland, and it would make them black or Asian or whatever. Yeah. So he said, I looked at the text thing, and he asked it to tell him something, you know, about Trump or about Biden, and it wouldn't talk about them. So it said, you know, tell me something about me, you know, about Matt Taibbi. And it came and made up all this stuff, and it was all really negative. And said, oh yeah, he's had a lot of complaints about his accuracy, and it cited a lot of made up articles, and then started cross-referencing these made up articles. I mean, it was literally automated defamation. And I've seen this from somebody else early on, which ChatGPT from OpenAI, it was a politician who was running. And OpenAI came back and made up a bunch of defamatory stuff about him as well. And their excuse with all this stuff as well, it's just in its early stages. And you agreed when you started to use this that it might have some issues and everything. So we can say whatever we want to about you. We can make up all kinds of detailed stuff. And that's the key thing about it. It's so detailed now that, and it's getting better at all this stuff. So if it is bots out there, and if they are putting stuff out like that, it's detailed enough so that it is believable. And people will look at this, and if they see it as a comment on a website, but even if they see it and know that it's coming from one of these AI chat programs that are prone to hallucinating, they're going to be inclined to believe it because, hey, it's like a computer printout. It's like these computer models that they have about climate change or about the pandemic or whatever. Everybody is going to be inclined.
It's literally, this is the scary thing. It is literally what Orwell described in 1984 when the past was rewritten. You know, everything that's online, if they manage to control everything that's online, they could literally erase the past and create a new past. And so I think the lesson here, and I've been doing this myself for many years, it's imperative that we have physical hard copy proof of the history of the past, including things like books that are now being rewritten so that we can show what they actually did say as opposed to what they're telling us they say now.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You got to keep that as a record. As a matter of fact, when we look at manuals that we're going to have in order to, be able to survive when things get really bad. CivilDefenseManual.com. He only puts it out in paper and everything. And by the way, we've got some other comments here. Narrow Way, Narrow Gate Ministries. Good to see you again. He says, what I find remarkable is the EV bikes are catching fire as well. People aren't being told about it. New York City Fire Department has had 3 times of fire calls already this year than last because of EV bike fires. Yeah, I talked about that a couple of days ago. Yeah. Just in a couple of months, they have surpassed what they used to have in a year. People are dying. They've tremendous number of fires. And it's like all of these different battery things, as they scale the thing up, it gets even worse. They got 2,000 of these e-buses, these electric buses in the UK. They're like a ticking time bomb.
They're going from 400 to 800 volt architecture now, if you can imagine, you know, the potential fire risk that's involved in that. And what about if it saves even more the time? You know, and apparently, again, another example, it doesn't seem to matter in this case, you know, that people are being killed by these things.
Yeah, that's right. Steering girl.
To make an omelet.
Yes. A Syrian girl says, right, Eric, I have a gray Honda CRV because I would have had to go up to the next level above EX if I bought a blue one. That's what they're doing with the color stuff. My son says, so I guess with these chargers, they can make the noise, they can make it shake. The only thing missing now is they need to have a gasoline flavored vape spewing out the back, you know. So maybe while you're charging your charger, they can give you the gasoline smell.
Yeah, remember the smellophone? They'll probably come up with that too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they probably will have the canned air, you know, the Perry air that you had in Spaceballs that they had, you could open that up.
I find this also incredibly depressing. You know, it was interesting back in, when was it, like 99 or 98, whenever the original Matrix came out, and you saw these people who were sort of like a fetus embedded in a pod, you know, and they were fed artificial reality, and in their minds, they thought they were living their lives. And, you know, you thought, wow, that's a really horrific concept. And it is becoming the reality. This is the Yuval Noah Harari vision for our future.
Oh, yeah. Or what was it, Wall-E, where they had all the fat people and, being on like the cruise ship space thing. Was that Wall-E? I think it was Wall-E. Yeah. Yeah. That I look at that and it's like, wow, these they really predicted this pretty well. They're kind of like The Simpsons. They know what the future is going to be like, and they put it in their cartoons. It's a couple of other things here before we run out of time here. ON61, thank you very much for a tip and the compliment. I appreciate that. And ON61 also said, I found the donation key on Rumble. So that's good, folks. Take a look, and if you need any help, we can show you where that is, and we would appreciate that. So you've talked about manual transmissions. What is the state of manual transmissions now, and why do they matter? And I think that they do, but what is the state of it right now?
Well, the state of it is that they are making something of a comeback in some segments. Toyota has brought out, once again, Toyota, a number of new models, including the Corolla GR, I think it is, with a manual transmission. And I think BMW is going to offer the manual in the Z4, which had previously been automatic only. Mm. But the overall trend is toward automatic only. Mm-hmm. And I think it's pernicious. It's not just because I'm an enthusiast and I enjoy driving cars with manual transmissions. I believe it's really important that people learn to drive and have a sense of themselves in relation to the vehicle. And if I had a kid and I was teaching that kid how to drive, I would teach the kid how to drive on a manual car because it focuses their
that's right
the driving. And that develops a habit and a skill set that takes you through life and makes you a better driver going down the road, even if you don't drive an a manual car going forward.
Yeah.
But, you know, the reason that the automatics are becoming so dominant is simply because they can be programmed. You know, once again, back to the government. Yeah. You can't program a manual transmission. You can program an automatic, an electronically controlled automatic transmission. And that matters because all these manufacturers have to comply with these tests that the government sets forth. So they set them up to shift a certain way and at a certain time to optimize things like fuel economy and to reduce emissions. And there you go. And that's why automatics have become ubiquitous now.
Yeah. It's a way of cheating on the test, except, oh, they don't like it when you cheat on them. Well, they do in some cases, don't they? If you go in the direction they want. I just had a listener who was talking about that the other day, did the same thing with their kid, as you're just talking about, same thing I did with my child, and said, you know, I'll help you if you get a manual transmission. And he said he wanted them to drive that because it does focus them more. And he says, of course, they also can't have the phone in their hand while they're doing the manual transmission. Yeah. So it's got a lot of real benefits there. But I always always love the manual personally, because it is such a more engaging process. And I find that I'm personally don't believe I'm as good and as attentive a driver when I am driving an automatic as I am when I'm driving a manual.
Because you don't have to be.
That's right.
You know, when you have a manual car, you kind of have to look down the road and anticipate, you know, the changing in traffic conditions and how you're going to respond to that. And in your mind, the gears are turning, you know, and then you're deciding which gear you're going to be in, what gear you're going to be in next, and so on. Whereas with your automatic, you just kind of zone out and listen to the radio.
Well, we're all going to have to get manual control of our government and our society. We're going to have to get it in gear pretty soon because time is running out. Thank you so much for joining us, Eric Peters at ericpetersauto.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Thank you. Have a good day. The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. TheDavidKnightShow.com.
If you like the Eagles, on a dark desert highway, the Cars, and Huey Lewis in the News, they say the hotter rock and roll is competing. You'll love the Classic Hits channel at APS Radio. Download our app or listen now at APSradio.com.